long.
Then to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and once again, we have another fascinating topic tonight. But before we jump off to that conversation, we've got our usual announcements to make. For tonight's show, like always, I would love to hear from the listening audience. So please send in your questions and comments to me at giascott@exogenynetwork.com. I promise I won't give out your name or an email, and I won't send you any spam. So don't be shy. I know you have something on your mind that you would love to have the answer to. And moving right along to our guest for this evening, we're going to skip any more babbling from me. Nick Brink, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself to the audience?
Okay. I am a I have been a psychologist for the last 40 years. I graduated from University of California in Los Angeles back in 1970 and then came to Pennsylvania. And in as a psychologist, I have found that the most useful techniques in psychotherapy are those techniques that use altered states of consciousness, beginning with dream work, with dreams, and then I got into guided imagery and hypnosis. And with hypnosis, I find that, I guess the best way is to give an example. Someone who comes to me, let's say, is depressed. They may say to themselves, well, I'm not going to be depressed. I'm going to get up and start doing things. But in saying that, they're ignoring what's going on deeper in their unconscious mind. In their unconscious mind, there's all kinds of things they may be saying to themselves. They may be saying, I'm no good, or everything sucks, or the world's crashing around me. They have to face those things, and the best way to get to those kind of unconscious things is through hypnosis, through taking them back through time, or having them go into the under. One way I do is have them go down a flight of stairs or down an elevator into their unconscious mind, and it reveals a lot about them. But in doing that, I'm the director. I have to make the suggestions. I have to lead them into trance. And I'm very involved. Then in 2005, 2006, I was the president of the American Association for the Study of Mental Imagery. And I was organizing a conference, and someone in the association said, well, I need to get Felicitas Goodman to be our keynote speaker. So I got a hold of her, and she agreed. But then everything went wrong with the conference. There was a big mix-up on printing, and the brochures didn't get out until the last minute, and so the conference ended up being canceled, so I did not meet her. But in doing so, I read her book. Her book is Where the Spirits Ride the Wind, and it was fascinating. So in 2007, at the International Association for the Study of Dreams, I offered a workshop. I had never used her techniques of ecstatic trance until then. I had the gall to jump in and just do it. And I was totally amazed at how effective it was. And so since then, I have used ecstatic trance. And Felicitas Goodman died about 4 or 5 years ago. but I started emailing Belinda Gore, who was one of her students and who's written two other books on ecstatic trance. And Belinda was a really a great person who would answer me, get back to me by email, and make suggestions and criticize me. And I learned so much from her about ecstatic trance. And she, at one point, told me I needed to get my certification in using ecstatic trance. And so she was my mentor, my teacher in doing that. And now I'm certified through the Cuamungi Institute in New Mexico. The Cuamungi Institute was founded by Felicitas Goodman, and it's on the Pueblo in New Mexico. The Pueblo Indians have 18 different pueblos rather than a reservation, and one group with the Puakis, and that's about 14 miles north of Santa Fe. And she's leased from the Pueblo 400 and some acres, and she has this institute up in this little arroyo up in the desert with five buildings where I go now most every summer for a couple of weeks for teaching workshops and training. It's a beautiful spiritual site. But I think I need to explain what the ecstatic trance is all about. I guess the best way to begin is what she did is she was from Felicitas Goodman was from Hungary, and she was got a degree in linguistics. I think it was in Germany. I think at Heidelberg, but she could speak like 20 languages. So when she came to this country, she was very popular on college campuses, where she was able to translate literature from many different languages. And while in her work in one of the universities in Ohio, she met a woman, an anthropologist, who became her mentor, and Felicitas then got her PhD in anthropology. And her professor, as well as Felicitas, were interested in the way she was induced in the primitive, or indigenous, about 183 indigenous cultures around the world. And where in those cultures, the shaman or the people would beat on drums, and that's the image I think most of us have, or shake rattles and dance in a circle or dance around a fire, and in that whole process they'd go into a trance. What Felicitas did is she decided to study, try to understand what it meant to speak in tongues, and so she went to several different apostolic churches in Mexico. She wanted to see it in different languages, so she went to a Mayan-speaking church, and she went to some Spanish-speaking churches. And she observed what the preachers did to bring the congregation to this point of ecstatic trance. And she came up with the holaries, six different requirements. One was to have a private physical space, in other words, the church. That really applied to hypnosis also. I think in hypnosis you need to have a quiet place. It was my office or a setting where people felt safe. The second thing she realized is that the congregation needed to expect going into a non-ordinary state of consciousness. It was just the way the people, the congregations did it, and so newcomers would have that whole sense of expecting to go into an altered state. The third point she brought up was a belief that the experiences were safe, enjoyable, pleasurable. And I think I need to add to that list also helpful or healing in some way.
Uh-huh.
The fourth step was a meditation experience of quieting your mind. In the church, it was a prayer. In doing hypnosis, it's just my quiet, soft, slow voice. I would speak in a voice, and I would watch the person breathing, and my voice would slow down to be at their breathing weight. And so I think those first four points really apply to hypnosis as well as to ecstatic trance. But The other 2 points that a static trance adds is one is a rhythmic stimulation to the nervous system. In other words, the beating of a drum or the shaking of a rattle, or in the church, the clapping of hands, or just the singing. There was a stimulation of sound to the nervous system. And so she went home to her university and with her students and used those steps to induce trance. And she was successful in inducing trance, but the trance was just sort of random or unending. There was something missing. And then she read an article by a Canadian psychologist who had looked at body postures for meditation, the lotus posture, or just sitting in a chair comfortably, lying down, whatever the postures might be that people used in meditation. And he found that the postures had an effect on the body in terms of skin moisture, body temperature, heart rate, breathing rate. The posture had a very direct effect on these different body functions. So Felicia says, then went back to her students. First, the light went on, and she looked in books on primitive art and also contemporary primitive art. And she found what she thought were like 50 different postures used by shaman in these different cultures. And she would have her students then stand, sit, or lay in these postures. And she found that the postures had a very direct effect on the ecstatic experience. Some postures were for calling energy into your body for healing. Some postures were for journeying into the underworld, and other postures for journeying in this world, and some postures for journeying into the upper world. Then there were those postures for divination, for finding answers to questions, and there was postures for shape-shifting or metamorphosis, becoming an animal, and there were postures for that induced aims. And that's what happened when I first did it at the Dream Conference. I found that those postures did just what she said. I was with a fairly sophisticated group of people because they were all dreamers, so they were used to altered states of consciousness. And it was very powerful to me to realize the effect that the posture had on the trance experience. So I came home and I formed a group here at home, and I've had this group going now since 2007. First we were meeting every week, now we meet about once or twice a month. But in doing so, I have collected well over 1,000, probably close to 2,000 now, ecstatic experiences that people had with these postures, and that's really what composed the book that I have written, the Power of Ecstatic Trance, Practices for Healing, Spiritual Growth, and Accessing the Universal Mind. So that's sort of what brings me up to date.
That's a lot of information. You know, and when people talk about ecstatic trances or trances in general, usually most people are referring to a state induced by the use of something like ayahuasca or peyote or one of these other concoctions, be they plant-based or chemical, that alter a state of consciousness and then send them on their journey. But you're talking about a completely, you might say, internal form. You don't consume anything to cause it. So are the experiences similar in any way?
When you think of the tribes, especially in Peru or South America, they use ayahuasca. They use different herbs and other things to help it. But they also induce trance just by drumming or by shaking rattles or by doing just what she said without the use of drugs. And I don't use the drugs myself. I think that we could attain these trances without it. Mm-hmm. And these trances have had very powerful effects of healing. And using hypnosis, I found that they were very effective in overcoming a lot of different emotional disorders. But since I've been using the static trance, I've even gone beyond that and realized how people could have a very similar or the same experience while in trance, even though they're not sharing through our usual senses these experiences. Or I could go back in time. I really feel like I've been able to go back in my life, as well as back to my ancestors, my distant ancestors. Uh-huh. So I find there's a lot of extrasensory type of experiences that could be attained through this kind of trance.
Well, I found the whole concept really, really interesting, because for a lot of people, the use of something like peyote or ayahuasca or any of the chemical ones, it's not an option due to physical problems or abnormalities that they may have. So for them to use one of these chemicals to induce this state would be dangerous. So I was like, there has to be another way to do this. If healing can occur during these trances, obviously if the method to get the trance would kill them before they got there, I was seeing a conflict, you know.
They often say that it does. I haven't heard of it. They often say that these drugs could kill a person, but I haven't heard of a case where they have died. And I guess the cases that are reported in literature are the ones where they're successful rather than dying. But, you know, but they always say that they can.
I used to spend a lot of time in emergency rooms in the Four Corners area for personal reasons. And it was not uncommon to see someone brought in from a peyote
set. I can believe that.
I never heard of them dying, but they were really sick when they came through that door. You know, I don't know, you know, what was going on with them. I didn't, you know, I just happened to see and hear what was going on, you know, because it was in the area. I didn't have anything to do with that. But, you know, it was something that kind of brought home, because I'd always been told, you know, if you go into a peyote ceremony with the wrong frame of mind, you know, things can go really wrong. And I was like, ooh, I've seen really wrong. Don't want to go there. Thank you. So, you know, for me, it had been kind of a scare tactic in a way, because of the fact that I had seen.
Sure.
It was like, no. I don't think I want to mess with anything like that, you know. And even from relatively mild things like sweat lodges, there's people that have had heat exhaustion and so forth and so forth. And this sounds like something that really there are no serious possible side effects.
I believe that they're not. I mean, they don't allow drugs at the Institute, and I have never used them with this. I have had occasionally a problem. Back using hypnosis, one thing I would do is I would have a person take an emotion. They come to me because they're overly anxious. And I would have them take that emotion, maybe write it down, maybe carry it with them back through time. I'd use time regression. And in one case, I had the person put their feeling in a backpack. And I made a mistake. I forgot to tell backpack off and leave it in my office. So they came back the next week complaining of such sore shoulders. They had carried it all week. I mean, it wasn't a serious problem, but, I mean, those kind of things can happen. And I've had something of that nature happen while using ecstatic trance.
Uh-huh.
So, that, I mean, there can be some negative effects, but nothing is that I have never had one that was lasting or really seriously detrimental. Sometimes they were just sort of humorous.
I had one person. Backpack is kind of humorous, but yeah, I could see where somebody after wearing it for a week would be complaining. I would be. I know that.
Sure, exactly. So, but and more often than not, in therapy, I need to know what the person's problem is, and we work on it. Here, people come to me for the sake of trance, and I usually don't have any idea of what if they're working on any particular problem.
Uh-huh.
It's only after the fact that it happens. Let me give you one example. This was one of the first ones that I had. This is right from the book. I was using a divination posture, and the experience that this woman had is I began in a womb, in a womb-shaped a cavern, den-like, a cave of branches. I was trying to figure out what animal I was. Then I realized I was a happy little girl, about 8 years old. I was alone, but happy and free. I was in a city on a sidewalk, and the city was gray and ugly. But I felt so alive and happy, I walked up the road that turned into a wide bridge in a very industrial city setting. I stayed on the bridge for a while, feeling happy, young, and free. Then I began to cross the bridge, and I realized it led into an enormous warehouse. I did not want to go in. I turned around, and behind me was the city, ugly and gray. Then I got very, very sad. I became annoyed because I could not get off the bridge. I wanted to change visions, but that did not work. I wanted to end the meditation, but I was still on the bridge. So I let all emotions escape me, and I entered the warehouse. It was hellish, a hellish landscape. I marched through and exited the other side. I was surprised to see a road continue on a beautiful and colorful landscape. I lay down in the grass. I knew it was beautiful, but I could not feel the same excitement. I was older now. She came back the following week and announced that she had not had a cigarette all week. She had been struggling to quit smoking, and I knew she had been struggling. I knew she was trying to quit, but we had not talked at all about why she was doing when she went into this trance. And this was her experience. She knew that it was going to be hell to quit, but in this case, her hell was this brief time of going through the warehouse. When she got through, she somehow didn't feel the same excitement. She was sort of let down, but she felt older, and she felt more mature, and she was able to quit smoking. When I look at the metaphoric language in this experiment, the experience, it really does tell the story of what it means to quit. I think that's one advantage I've had in working with dreams over the years. They speak in a very, and also hypnosis, they speak in a different language, in that language of metaphor. And when I become sensitive to that, I realize these stories are so relevant to the person and their life. Well, one thing I do is at the Institute, mostly instructors, people keep a journal and keep their own experiences. I have them write them down on a card, and I collect the cards. And then I email the experience back to them 4 or 5 days later so they have a chance to review it. But I also enter these experiences in a computer file. So I have them right at my fingertips, and that's what really gave me the content for this book.
Mm-hmm.
But the metaphoric language to me is beautiful, and it says, it gives you the answers.
Yeah, you know, I think about, you know, our subconscious is pretty sneaky. And a lot of times the metaphors it uses kind of leave you wondering, where did that come from? And what does that mean?
Exactly. And it often takes a while for it to brew inside of you for all of a sudden to see what it means.
And sometimes you don't ever figure it out. And then, you know, in my case, about a year ago, I had a dream about singing chickens, okay? Of all
singing
the things.
Singing chickens.
Singing chickens, yeah. Okay. And they weren't like cartoon chickens singing. They were clucking like chickens, but they clucked in a tune.
Oh, okay.
And for the life of me, you know, that one, yeah, I've had other people try to interpret it, but the interpretations that they've given it just didn't seem to quite fit. You know, when I thought about them a while. And, you know, after a year, I have no more insight into what possibly caused me to dream about singing chickens than I had a year ago. And usually when you think about something, you do figure it out. It might take you a year or so, but you do figure it out. And singing chickens kind of went, you know.
I had one dream. It took me a good 40 years before finally it made sense. What was your feeling about it? It was just sort of, what was your feeling about the chickens?
Oh, I was rather pleased with them. They were clucking so nicely to the tune. I was standing at, you know, one of these, I don't know, unless you're familiar with chicken pens, it's like a a doorway that lifts upward, and it was propped open and let him in. And I was standing on something, leaning in this window, which was would have been normally like, you know, my head height or something, but I was leaning with my arms on it watching the chickens, and they were in this chicken house full of hay, and they were clucking in tune. Home on the Range, as a matter of fact. You know, I don't know what it meant. I sometimes wonder, you know, did I drink some strange tea that something? I don't know.
Okay. What I used to do with a dream is to ask have the person describe the feelings. Then I ask, where in your life do you have such feelings? And I think when you follow the dream in terms of feelings, but in this case, it was. I don't know, my first thought, it was the chickens were being creative. You were finding something unusual and something that was fascinating to you. And, from, I know, just the little bit I know of you, that's just what you do. That's just what you do in this radio program. You're looking for interesting, different things. And here you found them in singing chickens.
Singing chickens. Well, the chickens have provided a couple of topics of a time or two during shows, simply because it is the goofiest, weirdest, most unexplained dream I've ever had.
You didn't invite the chickens to sing on your show.
No, I didn't. And I didn't try to mimic them either. Although I have to admit, my daughter's first sounds that she made on purpose was mimicking the sound of a young rooster crow, which is, if you've ever raised chickens, it's not a pretty sound. My 3-4-month-old daughter was copying that sound. And it was because what I would do is I used a backpack to carry her around. Well, if you have back in those days, if you had a baby in a backpack and you bent over, baby's going to jump out. It had legs, and I would set it outside the chicken pen, go in to tend to the chickens. I could see her, and she could see me, and she could watch the chickens while I was doing my thing with them. She didn't get pecked. I didn't drop the baby. You know, everybody was happy. Because I had, like, 150 chickens at that time. Anyhow, she spent a lot of time, obviously, watching the chickens while I was tending to them. And that was her first sound. So, you know, I guess I've had this long association with chickens, although I haven't had them in decades now. But,
you know, the associations are important.
Yeah, you know, and having chickens was just something I usually did as long as there wasn't a nasty-tempered red rooster involved. But, you know, these were just chickens. They weren't even specific kinds of chickens, because I'm aware of a number of different breeds. I've had a number of different breeds over the years. They were just vague chickens like you'd find on a farm that had been running loose breeding indiscriminately. Just chickens. And why they were singing, I don't know.
You found something. You found something unexpected or unusual, and that is
it stuck in my mind very, very clearly because I was like, you know, what kind of person dreams about singing chickens? You know, let's demented. That's weird. Yeah, and yet at the same time, because sometimes we'll have dreams that are somewhat weird, but there might be an embarrassing or humiliating factor in it. We wouldn't want to talk about them in public. Singing chickens, I mean, who cares about talking about them in public, you know? I don't tell anybody about it. I sing on chickens and think, oh, I think I'm weird. Yeah, there really isn't anything humiliating or embarrassing or anything. It's just one of those really, really dreams.
Yeah.
And it stuck in my mind because it was just hilarious in a way. I mean, because it was funny to think about singing chicken.
But the dream is still with you, and eventually it'll make a lot more sense. I had a dream, it was a good probably 45, 50 years ago, that this brood inside me, it hadn't made any sense, but really through this ecstatic trance and through hypnosis and through several things, pieces have been falling into place over the last quite a few years. The dream was I was walking along a dirt road, and there was a culvert alongside the road. And in the wall of this culvert, there was a hole. It looked like maybe a rodent hole. And from somewhere, I got a high-powered, like, fire, and I started squirting water into the hole. That's all the dream was. It was vivid enough, sort of like your dream. It was something that was stuck with me, but it just didn't make any sense. And then, I don't know, should I go ahead and tell the story?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Then, it must have been 10, 15 years later, when I was in the American Association for the Study of Mental Imagery, I went down to Washington, D.C. to one of their conferences, and I presented a paper on power struggles. But I went to someone else's paper, a René Pellier, who what he did is he had people identify their chakra, and he had them imagine an animal coming out of each of the chakra. And he did it four times. One time I saw, actually it was my first chakra, there was a buffalo, and I was riding the back of the buffalo, and I was very comfortable. The next experience, I was in a field and watching this deer grazing very contently. Another experience, I was sitting in an alley, and there was a trash can across from me, and right next to the trash can, there was a rat, or a mouse, and the mousy rat was asking my permission to rummage in the garbage can. The fourth experience I had, I was in a driveway, washing a car. It was like a suburban, house, and I haven't lived in, like that in years. I live out in the country. I have chickens too. But in this, there was a squirrel on a tree not far from me, and the squirrel was, beckoning me or asking me to climb the tree. And I was trying to figure out what these experiences were all about, and they just didn't sense to me. Then it happened that René Pellier came to my workshop the next day, and we ended up spending an hour or two talking about those experiences. And they still didn't make sense to me until I was driving home, and all of a sudden the light went on. I was trying to tie the experiences to the seven chakra, but I have an adopted daughter. She's now in her 45, but she was American Indian, and I, as a child, I was always reading to her Native American stories. It became and I think they were more important to me than they were to her. She could really care less about her Indian heritage. But one of the Native American stories is of the medicine wheel. And when I realized that these four images, when I placed them on the medicine wheel, they made a lot of sense. The deer, grazing contently, and me riding on the back of a buffalo contently, the antlered animals of the north. That's that spiritual side of ourselves. And I'm pretty content with that. Mm-hmm. The mouse and the squirrel are from the south. That's our childhood, our playful side of ourselves. And I realize that's where my struggle is. I grew up, when I went to school, I was always sort of the backwards, I always felt sort of inadequate. I was chosen last for the kickball team. I was dyslexic. I mean, but at least my early years in school, I was having a problem. And by willpower, I tried to say, I'm okay. It so happened that in the ninth grade, my English teacher, Doc Cross, she was pretty famous back then because she had entered a contest and won the contest and had paid for her whole complete college education. She was the one that wrote the original logo for Johnson & Johnson, the drug company. But uh-huh. With that, she won a complete college scholarship. But anyway, she's the first person that told me about the stages of getting college degrees, your bachelor's degree, your master's degree, and then you get your Ph.D., and I said to myself, I'm going to get my Ph.D. Even though I was dyslexic and even though I felt very inadequate, somehow I was going to prove that I could do it. And I did do it, and I always felt like it was a struggle. But anyway, my point is here, anyway, is the mouse and the rat. The rat wanting to rummage in the garbage can. I was still rummaging in these old anxieties and feelings of inadequacy. Even though I was a psychologist and doing well, I still felt deep inside that inadequate, mousy, rummage in the garbage can side. The squirrel, on the other hand, was saying, come climb the tree. Let's climb to a higher level. Let's climb the tree of life to find some spirituality. And so the squirrel became sort of my mentor of letting go. And overnight, I really all of a sudden let go of that feeling of anxiety. But I still valued that mouse. That mouse was sort of a humble, inadequate side. It was still part of me in some ways. Then, what was the next step? Then I was at the Institute in New Mexico, and I was I have it right here, don't I? Where is it here? I had another experience right from the book.
Okay.
This one here. Where is it here? Oh yeah, here it is. I found myself at both my power spots at Kuamungi and at the spot beside the road. I was a mouse looking up at me. I could feel my nose twitching as I was squeaking out, "Don't ignore me, don't ignore me," over and over again. "Don't ignore me," as you did for so many years. Then I noticed a coyote to our right. He put his face right against mine, then turned it back. He turned his back to me and repeated this sequence of gestures over and over. I understood this as the coyote making fun of me, and again telling me, "Don't so seriously." So the mouse, I think, when I started feeling confident, this was probably 15 years after I had that earlier experience of the mouse in the alley. But this experience at the Institute, where the mouse was yelling at me, "Don't pay attention to me," pay attention to me, was powerful. But then what happened, it was pretty amazing. We were doing what they call the mask trance dance, and we had to make our costumes. And from one of my experiences, I became a bear. And so I was making a papier-mâché bear mask. And the next morning at breakfast, one of the other guys in the workshop came up to me and said, did you see what happened to your mask last night? A mouse had chewed off one of the ears. then later that morning, we do our trance in a kiva at the Institute. We were in the kiva, and we were sharing experiences, and it was my turn, and I was sitting to the north side of the kiva, and the wall of the kiva is lined with masks from previous dances. People have left their masks there. And right above my head was a bear mask. And all of a sudden, something across the room let out a squeal. A mouse had poked his head up over the top of the bear mask and jumped over and ran across the kiva. So the synchronicity of the mouse kept coming back to me over and over and over again and told me I had to pay attention to it. And it was soon after that that I realized that dream I had many, many, many years before where I squirted water into that hole, that dream I was tormenting a mouse or a rat in that hole. That's what I was squirting the water in. I did not want to face it. I was not ready to look at what that mouse had to teach me. And it took like 30, 40 years later that all of a sudden that dream made sense. And now I was, over the last 10 years, I had been facing that mouse and becoming acquainted with it and overcoming it. But still, I can't ignore it. I still have to appreciate what it taught me.
Uh-huh.
So I think that was a very sort of a long experience. Of a big part of my life was dealing with that mouse over all those years.
Yeah, and something so small that can become so significant.
Yeah, so I imagine those singing chickens could be a similar kind of thing eventually. But
it could be. Chickens at the same time. They're fascinating, but I've always regarded them as kind of among the most vicious and gruesome creatures on Earth, because they'll eat each other. Yeah, they're nasty.
Yeah, they have a pecking order, and they'll peck at each other.
Yeah, and I've seen them turn on one and literally pick one to death.
Oh, yeah.
you know.
But usually, if you have a flock of more than I think about 20 or so, they that doesn't happen. So maybe when the flock is pretty small, do they really start pecking at each other?
And actually, I found it the reverse. When I had more chickens, I was more likely to have that.
Oh, really? Okay.
So yeah.
Maybe so, but okay.
You know, and I don't know what the deal is, but I did find them. I've always found them kind of repulsive in that way. You know, most people think of chickens as kind of fuzzy, cute chicks, and you know,
yeah.
Very very neutral kind of feelings towards chickens. And I really don't. I kind of usually regard them as kind of gruesome. In addition, I've had lots of encounters with really foul-tempered roosters. And I can remember one rooster, I would have to take a bat into the pen with me, and I literally was hitting it hard enough. I was hoping to kill it, to be honest. And I don't care how hard I hit it, how many times I knocked it across the pen, it never quit attacking me, ever.
Huh. That's the first rooster I would have eaten.
Well, he did get eaten because that batch of chickens happened to be my mother's. And I finally told her, I'm not going in there to take care of him anymore until you get rid of that rooster. You're going to have to do it. I'm not doing this anymore. And the next day, the rooster was done in, you know, because she didn't want to have to go do it. And she knew
right.
I meant it, you know, not going to deal with that rooster anymore. For one thing, it made me feel so cruel. You're taking this little small bird and you're beating it with a bat as hard as you can, trying to kill it, hoping to kill it. I mean, I didn't chase it down after I hit it and hit it again or anything like that. But when it would come flying at me, I'd swing that bat for all I was worth. And, you know, I wasn't weak or anything. I could, you know, I could and did stack 150-pound bales of hay. I was not physically weak. There was no wimpy about the way I was hitting this chicken. And, yeah, after about the fifth or sixth time of it getting hit, it would kind of stagger for a minute or two, which would give me enough time to grab the water container. But no, it never did stop attacking me until it finally got to the point it's so ridiculous that I just said, okay, I'm not doing this anymore. Because it did. It made you feel terrible.
Yeah, because another thing I've realized is I now, through these experiences, I'm always looking for power animals, animals that I could learn from. And the mouse is one, the squirrel is one, the deer, the buffalo, I've had, the coyote. I have a lot of animals that I really experienced their spirits, and I've learned so much from them. A chicken hasn't been one of them, no. I haven't really spent time
they're smarter
with a chicken.
Domestic turkeys, but in terms of intelligence, I wouldn't put chickens very high up the ladder.
Right.
Yeah, they're not the brightest creatures on earth. Then again, you know, that's the domesticated animal. The domestic turkey and wild turkeys have very little in common.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the DNA must be somewhat related, but domestic turkeys are so stupid they'll drown.
They are so stupid.
Yeah, when anybody goes hunting for wild turkeys, oh no, this is very... Now, I have to admit, I encounter them accidentally because I'm not looking for them. But hunters who are hunting them, they go to a lot of work. They say it's hard. And I'm like, okay, I've literally stumbled onto them. I can't be that hard, but okay. But maybe the difference is, you know, I'm not looking to kill one, therefore I'm not a threat when I'm out in the woods. I don't know. But, yeah, the hunting the wild turkey is very, very difficult. And yet, domestic turkeys will stampede over thunder and kill each other. They will stand in the rain until they literally drown from raindrops. You know, they're stupid. They're really stupid.
They very much are. I mean, I think turkeys are one of the more stupid birds. You know, when you're saying this, it makes me really think that I had a real realization this last 6 months or so. I was reading a book by Jim Mason, Unnatural Order, and he looks at the history of mankind from hunters and gatherers up through the hunter and gatherers up through the agriculturalists and up to now. And he really feels that where we went wrong is became agriculturalists. When we were hunters and gatherers, we were much more in tune with nature. When we became agriculturalists, we got into domesticating animals and trying to control the earth. And over the last 10,000 years, that has led to the point now where we're really in the process of destroying the earth. But in doing this, this made me do a lot of thinking about animals. Phrase he talks about is from the Bible where it says, man shall have dominion over the earth. He really feels that was where we sort of started going wrong, and he refers to us as dominionists. And where can we really get back in touch with nature, get back in touch with that we continually put ourselves superior to animals, superior to the everything around us, but animals have so much, and I think it's through these ecstatic experiences that I have realized the bear, really the eagle, those two in particular. I have gone through prostate cancer, and the bear and the eagle both were very big parts of my healing. But I cannot look at them as being inferior to me because they both have taught me a lot. And so
I look at bears as being particularly threatened. It happens to be the one animal in the wild I am actually afraid of, really afraid of. And even the small black bears that are found in the south where I live now, I wouldn't want to encounter one in the woods. I never have, but I am definitely afraid of bears. And, you know, I've never had a bad encounter with bears. I've never been closer than 75 yards and pulling away. I never want to get any closer than that either.
I would keep my distance.
Yeah, you know, and maybe my fear comes from years ago I lived in Arizona in an area that I frequented a lot and camped in a lot. Happened to have a sow bear with an unusually foul temper. And she was notorious. She chased motor vehicles. I was driving one of the ones she was chasing once. She had a really bad temper. And she chased people on four-wheelers and so forth and so on. And, you know, maybe the fear that I have about bears originates from always being aware to stay clear of that particular bear. Because most bears are not like that.
Yeah. Well, I would keep my distance from a bear if I see bears periodically. I remember several years ago I was driving across the George Washington Bridge into New York City, and it occurred to me, I bet I'm the only person in the whole city that had a stop that morning to let a bear cross the driveway. As I was leaving to go to the city, a bear walked across our driveway. I'm a beekeeper, and I've had bears in my beehives, and so I put an electric fence around the beehives, which will not keep a bear out unless you hang pieces of bacon over the electric wires, because then the bear tries to go at it with its mouth and it gets shocked and will stay away. I run that little trick to keep bears out of our beehives. So I know I have learned to respect bears, but still when it came to my cancer, I thought the bears were very nurturing. They were also showed me their strength. In my ecstatic trance, I had a whole series of interactions with bears that taught me a lot. And the same thing with the eagle. The eagle taught me how to rise above some things in my life and go with the flow. Both animals taught me so much.
Do you find it different the type of symbolism an animal will have between people of different cultures?
Oh, very much. But what's important is the one it has for you. Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated by how different people see them differently that way. But, you know, in my own experiences, these become very personal to me, so they're not realistic, but still, I feel like I've learned so much from each of these animals.
Uh-huh.
The coyote making fun of me, just laughing at me, that's another powerful one. So,
well, that's interesting, you know, because a lot of times, a lot of people will tell you, too, that, you know, seeing a black dog means one A, B, or C. Whereas for somebody else, they may have an culturally complete different set of symbolism for a dog. That sort of blanket universal interpretation may not hold true.
Yeah, one thing I'm sort of down on is these catalogs of dream interpretations, these encyclopedia that give you a symbol in a dream and tell you what it means. Those are, to me, that's not very effective. To me, if I look at something in your dream and I look at the emotion, then I ask you, what part of that is you, or how do you relate to it? You have your own, it means something very specific to you, and it may not match what these catalogs or these dictionaries of dream symbols have to say, because it's your own image, it's your own experiences on life that define what the animal or what the other symbols may be. So in doing dream work, I really stay away from those type of trying to define them. Yes, different cultures have very different beliefs about all kinds of symbols, and I think they're fascinating.
Because to some people, the coyote is often a symbol of trouble and mischief, whereas somebody else may find it a symbol of humor.
It's the trickster,
right?
It's always playing tricks on you, and that's what the coyote was to me. That was a very archetypical meaning to me. It was just that.
And like to some, I know one perfect example is to some cultures, the raven is a symbol of wisdom and whatnot. To others, it is a symbol of destruction and disaster, as in the raven picking out, so it's kind of, like almost polar symbolism.
Very much, yeah.
The same creature, right?
I think the color green. The color green means life, but it also means death. I mean, it's also rotting and disintegrating, but it also means birth and growth, the color green. So I think so often they are opposites that way. Just like the raven. The raven that sits on Odin's shoulder gives Odin the knowledge. In other places, it's destructive, right?
Yeah, kind of a gruesome creature. I guess I fall more on the gruesome side because too often I had seen them eating carrion, so they kind of give me the same creepy feeling as a turkey vulture does,
Uh-huh.
And other people may see the turkey vulture as this noble creature. To me, they're just big, nasty, ugly birds.
Ugly.
Yeah, they definitely aren't going to qualify on any beauty scale because they are very, very ugly birds with their naked head and dark feathers and whatnot. And they're large. Anybody who's never come up on one, a group of them feeding on carrion or roadkill, and seen them taking off somewhat awkwardly in front of your vehicle, my fear was always that I was going to hit one. Sort of like the owl. And for a lot of people, they're a symbol of wisdom. When I think of an owl, I remember I used to drive a Jeep with no top. And after having an owl drop, coming up on it on a road at night, it dropped a jackrabbit on the hood of the Jeep. Well, I'd also often seen them drop rattlesnakes because they eat a lot of rattlesnakes, too. My worst fear is they were going to drop one, it was going to land in the Jeep, and it was not going to be dead. I was sure it was going to wreck.
I walked into our chicken coop several years ago, and there was a big barn owl standing right in the middle of the chicken coop. I think I got it before, I scared it out before it got any of the chickens, but it was looking for its meal right there, so.
Yeah. Chickens are usually smart enough to roost in the chicken house, but every now and again, they get kind of dorky and they'll decide that roosting outside is for some reason a good idea. But, there again, chickens aren't the brightest creatures on Earth. That's why coons and mink and coyotes and bobcats and just about every other predator regards them as chicken dinner.
As chicken dinner, right.
Chicken dinner, yeah. Deep prey.
A whole nother area of it. Okay, a couple of things that I like to mention about ecstatic trance. Just a little bit about how these postures work. And postures are. I mean, I have a slideshow here, but you can't see them.
Sounds like it's going to take more than just a minute or two, and we are only a minute or so out from break. So I'm going to make you hang on to that thought.
Okay.
We don't have to interrupt it, but we'll come right back to that after our break. So, folks, while we are away from your computer, don't move a muscle. Don't click away. We're going to take ourselves a little short break, and we'll be right back with more conversation with Nick Brink about the postures for ecstatic trance.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hey, hi there. Got your attention? I'm Gia Scott, and I was curious what you were doing from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time on Tuesdays. See, I host this really interesting little radio program that airs live then, and we bring in all sorts of guests. Authors, experiencers, and everything in between. It's paranormal and guaranteed to make you go, My guest list is always up at www.giascott.com, and do tune in to the Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesdays.
Breaking news. Strange black pyramid UFO ships over every major city on the Earth. People are exhilarated and scared. Reptilian strange creatures are beaming down. My God, they're beaming me up with them. Don't put that probe there. Don't put that probe there. Don't put the... Listen to the Church of Mabus radio show at 11 p.m. Eastern, Saturday nights with host Jeffrey Pritchett, bringing you The High Strange. Visit www.churchofmabusradio.com. That's www.churchofmabus.com.
Tune in to The Mind Cemetery with your hosts Chip and Nicole every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern.
Exclusively on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. We delve into UFOs, abductions, ghosts, aliens, conspiracies, and cryptozoology.
And how could you ever forget about those creepy topics you won't hear on your local news?
This is where I would insert my obligatory skeptical statement. The Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
Follow us on Twitter and subscribe to us on Facebook. Also, check us out on our website, mindcemetery.com, for show updates and the critically acclaimed Mind Cemetery blog.
It's not critically acclaimed, but you should check it out anyway, mindcemetery.com.
Hey everybody, this is Jill Marie Morris from Perspective X. If you've been searching for a variety talk radio show with an edge, then look no further. Join my co-host Stephanie Benetti and I as we get down and dirty discussing the latest hot topics and relevant newsworthy stories. Informative, engaging, and quite often controversial, Perspective X is a unique blend of insight, opinion, and wit. So tune in every Wednesday night at 10 p.m. on UPRN 107.9 FM New Orleans. It's not just an opinion, it's our perspective. Perspective X.
Hi everybody, this is Erica Getch. I hope to see you on Friday at 8 p.m. Pacific on the Galactic Connection, keeping you connected 1 hour at a time. For more information, please visit thegalacticconnection.com.
You are listening to UPRN 107.9 New Orleans.
to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I am your host, Gia Scott, and tonight we are talking with Nicholas Brink. Now, don't forget, send in your questions to my email, giascott@exogenynetwork.com. But before we get started again, Nick, would you let everyone know where they can find your book?
Okay. The book is The Power of Ecstatic Trance, Practices for Healing, Spiritual Growth, and Accessing the Universal Mind. It's published by Barron Company, so you can get it from Inner Traditions Barron Company. You can get it from Amazon on the internet or from Barnes & Noble. It's sold by most of these book companies.
Okay, and just out of curiosity, is it also available as an e-book?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Like through Barnes & Noble's Nook and Amazon's Kindle?
Yes. I saw it was available through Amazon Kindle. I haven't checked the ebook part of it on Barnes & Noble, though. And I know it's available as an ebook from the publisher.
I happen to be a huge fan of the ebook because, I can have, right now I have like way too many books in my e-library, but it takes up much less room than my physical library does. And it's much easier to move. I can close my laptop and move it to another room all in one fell swoop, you know?
I have a Kindle, and I really like it in some ways, but I'm a page flipper. I like to go back and mark things, and it's to me, just a hardback book, I could do that much more effectively than with Kindle. So
I find that I like both forms, and reading research, you know, I'm not alone in that. There's some things that the bound version I prefer. There's other things that, for novels, I vastly prefer an e-form because you read through them, they don't take up.
With a novel, yeah, sure. With a novel, that'd be perfect, I think. But,
yeah. And even in some reference books where I'm just looking for small amounts of information or just to scan through it and see if it has anything I'm interested in, something that I don't refer to often. I like the e-form, but, other things that I refer to often or that I may want to drag off because I use it on my laptop. I'm not sure I want to commit to a Kindle yet, but on the laptop, I love it because of the big screen, too. I'm suffering from a lot of things Americans are now suffering from called aging eyes. And aging eyes. And, why it's also gotten me finally into bifocals. The larger print is much more comfortable to read. So, but getting back to your book, you know, there's a lot of topics in here. And before we went on break, you were ready to talk about some of the postures that are used and why they're used.
Right, exactly. No, I think it's very useful to... I wish I had a way to show it over the radio, but it doesn't work. But let's talk about each of the areas of postures and what the postures are like. The first one I think about is the healing posture, where you the experience that you typically have is you have a feeling of warmth or a feeling of energy flowing into your body, and that energy is for healing or for giving you a higher level of ego strength. the posture, the main posture for that is, we call it the bear spirit posture. You are standing erect with your feet just shoulder width apart, and you have your hands resting on your abdomen. And while resting on your abdomen, you could feel if you're breathing from your diaphragm like you should be breathing, you feel your hands rising and falling. You could feel, it really, in that posture, you could really feel the energy flowing into your body. And I picture as you exhale, that energy goes deeper inside of you. So I think when you think about what the posture is doing to the body, the kinesthetics of it as you're standing there, it really does explain why you feel that it's.
Well, it looks like we may have lost our guest. Or is he there? Well, I guess we'll have Nick back in just a minute here. But in the meantime, he was talking about the bear posture.
Hi.
Ah, nice to have you back again, Nick. You were talking about the bear posture, standing, you know, with your feet apart and your hands on your abdomen.
Right.
And feeling your breathing, you know, that you're breathing from your diaphragm.
And you can feel the energy flowing into your body. So what that posture really is expressing is that energy flow. When you think of the divination postures, most of those postures, you're sitting cross-legged, or you're sitting on a low stool, or maybe you're sitting with your knees up. But the typical posture is you have your left hand, you may have your elbow on your knee, but you have your left hand raised, or in one of the postures, maybe your left hand is stroking your beard, or your chin. And when people look at that posture, the different pictures of it, the first thing that comes to their mind so often is Rodin's The Thinker. But in The Thinker, your hand is against your face, and so the posture is closed. With these postures, usually your hand's away from your face, except for the one where you're stroking your chin. But it leaves it open to where you're thinking. You're trying to find answers to questions. It's the divination posture. And I picture that the Salafani answers come from what I would call the universal mind. Or within yourself from your own unconscious, but I think often from beyond your unconscious, or your universal mind. The postures for a spirit journeying, one posture is for flowing into the underworld, or journeying into the underworld. That's the only posture where you're lying down. There is a, one of these postures was found in one of the caves in France. The lying down postures, one was found in a picture from of the Sami reindeer herders in Finland, where he's lying on his back with his hand reached out over his head. Then there is the one from Michael Harner's book on shamanic journeying, where he's lying on his stomach with his arms stretched out. I also found a similar posture in one of the petroglyphs or rock carvings near Tanum, Sweden, on the west coast of Sweden, just before you get to Oslo, Norway. There's many, many, many petroglyphs along the rocks in that area of Sweden, and I found so many of these postures in those rock carvings. But it makes sense. If you want to go into the underworld, you're very likely close to the earth. Your head is against the earth. It's either on the back of your head or the front of your head is against the earth. While journeying in the middle world, the posture was found in, it was one of the islands in the Mediterranean, it's a fairly old one, where she is standing with her one arm, her right arm, hanging to her side, sort of pointing to the earth, and the other arm across her abdomen. And she's a very heavy-set woman. She's really planted. She's really planted on the earth. And the whole sense of, I think the whole posture, when you look at it, it's saying to you, I am here. I'm here on the earth. While the postures for journeying into the upper world are, you're lying at a 37-degree angle from the earth. You're not planted on the earth, and you're not against the earth, but you're sort of unstable at a 37 degree angle. Again, I have found several of those postures. One was from Egypt and a rock carving. Another was from one of the caves in France, and also from Sweden. The whole Swedish mythology, I think, is fascinating in terms of these postures. If you die of illness and old age, you go into the underworld. And if you die a hero in battle, you go to Valhalla, which is in the upper world. And I think in these rock carvings, you see both kinds of figures, figures that have, that did not die a hero. And they're lying horizontal, or the ones that are victors, or ones that died in battle, but as a hero, they're floating in the air at like at a 37-degree angle. One of the very oldest postures we found is 32,000 B.C. It's the Dahlenberg posture. It is was found along the banks of the Danube River. It's a woman who is standing, but her arm is outstretched, again, at a 37-degree angle. And each of these postures, when we didn't know what they were trying to express, but as we use them, it becomes more and more clear. And this Venus of Hildenberg, where her arm is extended out at a 37-degree angle, after experiencing it a few times, it becomes very clear that it is an upper world posture. It carries you. Then there are the postures for metamorphosis, for shape-shifting, becoming an animal. The most powerful one for me is the Olmec Prince, where I'm sitting on the ground cross-legged, and the knuckles of my hands are resting on the ground in front of me. So in other words, my arms are as if they're front legs of an for like an animal. But I'm sitting on my back legs rather than standing on them, so they aren't useful for walking. So I sometimes am a bird, other times I become a snake. But again, I think the posture expresses that of an animal. And the final category is the initiation or death rebirth postures. And the most common one that I use for that is the we call the flying serpent. It's and you're standing with the backs of your fingers at your hips and your elbows out. Sort of, if you remember the nursery rhyme, I'm a teacup. In this case, this teacup has two handles with your elbows sticking out on either side. Mm-hmm. If you stand in that posture, what is the feeling? The feeling is, my thought is, of defiance or of I am ready, sort of a determination, a type of posture. And I think if you are ready to, if something in your life you've been facing, it's, and you're ready to let go of it, ready to let that part of you die and have a rebirth, you do that with that sense of determination or a sense of defiance. Earlier in the whole process of change, you may be afraid to death. But by the time you're ready to face that death and have that rebirth, I think that posture is very expressive of where it leads you. So I think when you look at each of these postures, they really do express what we have found the postures have you do. What we do at the Institute, or what we do, is we refer to it as the Kulamungi technique. When Felicitas first started getting into ecstatic trance, she went into these apostolic churches. But to take it out of that religious context, she came up with her own more of a Native American type of ritual, or she doesn't like to attach it to any particular tribe or particular culture. But what we do is we, generally I take about 2 hours for a session. And the first, maybe 15 minutes or so, I show the group a posture, and we experiment with it. We sit in it, we lie in it, we stand in it, and I make sure that the person is holding the posture in the correct way. And sometimes we go around the circle and people share their concerns or what they want to accomplish or just sort of express themselves if there's something within them that they need to express. The next step is we do a cleansing, smudging part of a ceremony where we have a bundle of usually sage or different types of herbs, and we each person brushes the smoke from this burning herbs over their body. When I do it, I often don't use the burning herbs because that smokes up the room. I will use a oil scent poured on a piece of wicking in an abalone shell, and we cleanse ourselves with the scent of the oil. Then we have five. I don't know. Then we call the spirits of the six directions, and I have sort of a medicine wheel I have in the center of the circle, and as we call the spirits of the six directions, we offer the spirits some cornmeal, and typically in the kiva we just sort of toss the cornmeal. Again, if I'm doing this in a hotel room or in someone's home, I will put the cornmeal on this leather medicine wheel I have painted in the middle of the room. After the calling the spirits, we then have 5 minutes of silence where we quiet our mind, where we just focus on our breathing and really try to let go of tension and thoughts. Then at the end of that 5 minutes, I start either shaking the rattle or beating the drum at a pretty rapid rate of like 210 beats a minute. So we have found that rapid beat is the most effective. And we do that, the person takes the posture and sits in the posture as I'm beating the drum or shaking the rattle, or sometimes I might use a recording of the rattle or the drum if I really want to get in. No, even when I'm beating the drum, I get in because everyone else is into it too. Even though I cannot take the posture totally, since I have a drum in my hand and a drumstick in the other.
Mm-hmm.
But then we do that for 15 minutes. And at the end of the 15 minutes, we do a concluding rapid drum beat or rattle shake. And then we come out of trance and people write down their response. And like I said, I've collected well over 1,000, probably close to 2,000 of these responses now. And that is those stories, those narrative ecstatic trance experiences are a big part of the book. And a lot of the book is about how to interpret the metaphoric language that comes out of these experiences. But then there's sections about looking at, I gave you an example during the first hour of this person who the experience allowed her to give up smoking. But I've had so many other experiences. And I'd like to take a couple of minutes here to share some of those experiences.
Sure, go ahead.
Another one is an experience of, let me see, I have all these bookmarks in the book here. Another one is one of there it is. I'll read the experience and I'll tell you about what happened afterwards. I was in the scene. I was in the scene holding a baby. Next thing I knew, I was I was underwater, but not alarmed. There was a lot of seaweed and fish, and suddenly the baby swam away rapidly. In the distance, a form approached. Approached me, and turned out. It turned out to be my mother. She said, "Don't be alarmed. When you swam away, it was much faster than that." Then it got dark and cold, and I laid down on the bottom of this on the bottom in the sand, and I realized I was sinking into the sand and looking up like a flounder at the activities of the sea creatures, the kelp and the seaweed. I started sinking through the sand down into a cave where it was very hot and stank of sulfur. there was phosphorescent creatures, and I felt very uneasy. This was all also a strange blue neon glow. For this woman, her husband had died several years before, and now her daughter had just left to go away to college. And she was feeling the empty nest. She was feeling somewhat depressed because all of a sudden she was by herself. And here this experience gave her some reassurance when her mother told her, well, you swam away faster than that. So again, that was, she found considerable relief from her depression after that experience. So those are a couple examples of healing. But there's other kinds of experiences too. And one of them I'd like to talk about is what I refer to as mutual experiences, where in the group, well, I practically always do this in groups, but where two people have very similar experiences. It's, well, we're sort of reading each other's mind, or there's that extrasensory perception between us, even though we're not talking. One of my favorites is I saw this this woman dissolve in my experience, saw into all these shimmering colors. And these colors first sort of went up and down several times, then they flew back and forth across the room, and then out the door. And we went out the door, and up in the hillside behind the house here, we became trees. This other person's experience, she saw the tops of our heads pop open, and out of our heads flew all these colorful birds. And these birds flew back and forth through the room and out the door. And then we went out the door, and then we became marble statues outside. So even though the experiences were different, they were so similar in terms of this the content of it. This has happened over and over again. Let me see here. I have another one of those examples. I told Vestra, but I have one here from the... Okay, this one here. I looked from the mouth of a cave on a cliff into the brilliant sunlight. The day quickly turned to night. Waves crashed against the cliff, and below, as night fell, the lights of a town appeared. I wanted to go to the town, so I descended first on a tree to a zip line, my hips pushing me through the air until I floated freely. Instead of a town, I landed on a warm bioluminescent water. I swam with fantastic, brilliant creatures, and it was great fun. The seaweed made percussion sounds. When I surfaced, I saw an island, and it was Japan. Even though it was at the distance, a kabuki performance with huge figures was visible. I performed a dance that complemented the kabuki, and the seaweed made music. I wanted to go to Japan, but I didn't arrive. Physically, I was hot from head to toe. Compare that to my experience at the same time with the same posture. Where's it here? Here it is. I got very hot fast. I kept getting hotter and hotter. Eventually, I found myself flying towards the sun. I felt myself as a comet. As I flew through the space, I felt my arms encircling a large gas bag. And as I pressed against the bag, gas shot down my legs to my feet and propelled me through space. As I flew, I felt a cool breeze begin to cool me. It was very black in space with bright stars shining. At first, I could see the bright shining Earth getting smaller. I was no longer going towards the sun, but out through space. Again, we had not talked about this ahead of time in any way, but these were our two experiences. Both of us were propelled, sort of she by jets and me by this gas coming out of this bag that I was pressing on. Both of us saw lights. She saw them of this town and the bioluminescence in the water, I saw from the stars and looking back at the Earth. But again, the experiences were so similar.
Right down to both of you being hot.
Excuse me, what's that?
Right down to both of you being physically hot.
Right. Well, yeah, she got hot at the end. I got hot at the beginning, and then it cooled down. So, that, I mean, the heat was part of both of them, but that was a little opposite. But still, it was
right
there.
Yeah, yeah.
I did this with a group of seniors here in the area. We had 8 people in the group. And one time we divided up into pairs. So there was 2 of us in each group. And the only instruction I gave is just when you go into trance, pay attention to the other person. And when you look at the 4 pairs, again, each pair, the experiences were very, very similar. The person that I paired myself up with, we both had a lot of spiraling energy, just going around in spirals. Another 2 women that were doing it together, both became birds flying through the blue sky. Well, they were different birds, but they were birds. And one of my favorites from that experience, one couple that was a husband and wife, and the husband was walking along the beach holding his wife's hand, and the wife's experience was her hand was getting so tired. So, I don't know. I think most every time I've done this in a group, if we take a little bit of time to look at our experiences, we see such similarities that suggest that somehow there's some sort of extrasensory communication that is not through our usual senses.
Yeah, that is interesting, and the imagery seems to be fairly vivid. Now, when you do these ecstatic trance group sessions, you know, how long is a person in this altered state of consciousness?
15 minutes. The drumming lasts 15 minutes, but I know there's been times when it's taken me for 10 minutes to come out of trance where I've continued beyond the end of the drumming. And a lot of times during the 5 minutes of just quieting our minds, a person's trance starts. So the beginning and end may not always be just with the beginning and ending of the drumming or the rattling. And then there's a whole other area of beyond our, let me just talk briefly about some of the theories of how extrasensory perception works. One of my favorites is Rupert Sheldrake. He talks about the morphic field. When you think of the universe, there's the gravitational fields that hold the planets in line and going around the stars. And this, when you look down, clear down to the atom, we have the electromagnetic field that holds the subatomic particles together in the atom. So the whole universe is tied together with these different kinds of fields. And what Sheldrake points out is that in physics we talk about those fields, but when we get to biology, somehow we ignore them, but they're still there. That our body is composed of atoms, and each of these atoms have these electromagnetic fields. And these atoms compose the cells of our body. And he says that our cells have their fields, and our liver has a liver field, and our heart has a heart field, and our whole body has a field. And he refers to these as morphic fields. And he says human beings have a certain kind of field that connects all human beings together. And this knowledge is stored in these fields. And he believes that this knowledge is available to us from our ancestors and from way back. And I've experienced that from my, I've had my first experience with an ancestor. I think I had up here too. Let me find it here. I was using the Halsted Warrior Posture, which was an underworld posture, or we call it specifically the Realm of the Dead, in that case. And here we go. In this posture, I went back to the 5th century B.C. in Germany. That's when that particular posture was dated. Likely one of my ancestral places of origin, because a lot of my ancestors were from Germany. I was in a thatched hall, long and narrow, that was near the entrance of a cave. One man wearing a bearskin was with me, not the chieftain, but the second or third in command. He told me that we were preparing for a hunt tomorrow morning, and some of the men were drawing in the dirt pictures of animals and drawing spears stuck in the animals. Others were carving on the ends of their spears. He then told me that since I was from the future, I must have some wisdom or knowledge to help in the hunt. I shook my head no, but he was insistent that I was to lead them in tomorrow's hunt. We slept on the dirt floor around the fire, and in the morning, I took the men in what felt like a random direction, but we did come to several deer, and I motioned for the men, about a dozen of them, to spread out, and we herded the deer over a cliff. They all appreciated me, and though I still felt like I did nothing, or had no special knowledge. That was the very first time that I really felt like this person I was with was an ancestor. And since then, I have, I guess 40 or 50 of these experiences where I have intentionally gone back to be with my ancestors. A lot of them were in Denmark and Sweden. And I went back to some very early times when they still worshipped the Mother Goddess. Then I went back to a period of time during the transition when they started giving up that worship of the Mother Goddess and became the Viking warriors. Then I came into even farther to where I was really with a lot of the with a Viking chieftain, and in each case, I was with a family. I became part of the family in each of these cases, where I was either the father or often one of the sons who was having some extraordinary powers and was moving in the direction in life of becoming a shaman. And these experiences have actually become part of the next I've written that is now in the hands of the publisher, and I have not heard yet whether they're going to accept it, but I did get some good feedback from them so far, so I'm hopeful. Mm-hmm. But I really had that feeling that these experiences have allowed me to go back in time and experience what life was back way back then. That's another thing I should mention. In going back in time, it was a very powerful experience. Back in, I think it was 07, 08, I went to a conference in Denmark. And while I was there, I had made contact with Thorn Scyther. The year before, there was a group of people in Denmark who worshipped the old gods, the Thor and Odin, and to become a church in Denmark, you have to petition the state church, the Lutheran Church. And they did, and the Lutheran Church gave them permission to form their own church. Mm-hmm. And I invited myself to go to their midsummer celebration. And So I met a group of them, and I still email them regularly. I still maintain the contacts with them. But in the celebration, we were out on a burial mound on the island of Foon at Galvandrup, sort of on the north part of the island. And we were in a circle. There was about 30 of us. And we passed a horn of mead around the circle, and we did it four times. And I know the last time that each person in the group would go pile to one of the ancient gods or goddesses and give a little story about why that particular god or goddess was important to them. The third time, the time before that, they went around the circle and they each expressed some concern they had about themselves or about their relationship with somebody else in the circle. It was sort of a bonding type of experience. But I could not remember the first two, what the first two cycles of the meat were. I just was racking my brain to remember. So I wanted to write it down. This was just this last year. So I went into an ecstatic trance, and I let myself go back to that day on the island of Foon and re-experienced the whole experience. And what I saw was the first time around the circle, each person gave thanks to the Mother Earth, to the world around them, to the great weather, talked to the spirits of the earth. The second time around, the two people in the center of the circle that were sort of leading this had a large ring, and people would put something in the center of the circle that they wanted blessed. And the priest and priestess would hold this ring over that something and pour some mead through it onto whatever was put in the center. And Peter, the guy who was standing next to me, who's become sort of a friend, he had a Mjolnir, the Thor's hammer, around his neck on a chain, and he took that off and he put that in the center of the circle. And then when he took it and put it back on again, I saw him very clearly put it on backwards, with what was usually facing out was facing towards his chest. And so I emailed him, telling him what I saw, and he emailed me back and said that was exactly right, that he has an inscription on his Mjolnir that is sort of a secret, and he keeps that face down so people don't see it. It's sort of a little part of his ritual that he likes to keep that particular word written in root.
Mm-hmm.
And it really blew us both away that I had seen that so clearly in my ecstatic trance when I went back to the experience to remember what happened. So,
yeah, that is interesting.
So, I mean, I just gained so much confidence in the power of these experiences. And as a psychologist, I did have occasionally someone go back in time to a past life, but I never really took it very seriously. I thought their experience was important in therapy, and we'd work with it therapeutically, but I didn't, you know, I didn't not believe that it was a past life, but I didn't really focus on that. But now I really do believe that we have that ability to experience things beyond our usual senses in many different ways.
Right. I guess, in a way, I became a believer of that kind of ability after I guess you sort of spontaneously experienced like a time shift. And it wasn't people or anything. It was a physical place that I was at in
uh-huh.
which it was like all of a sudden I saw it in another time in the past, a long time ago, and
uh-huh.
it was very, very strange. And it was, you know, purely an accident. It was one of those times when you're just standing there, just, you know, and you kind of let your mind just go blank. I mean, there's literally nothing. People say, "What are you thinking about?" And you say nothing, and they never believe you. But there are times when your mind just does kind of go blank. You're not thinking about anything. I was
going into a trance. It's an altered
yeah.
state.
Yeah, and in my case, it was an accident. That wasn't my intention. I was just,
right.
watching the water and the waves and the wind and leaning back against the truck and just standing there. And it was like, whoa, how did that happen? You know, it kind of scared me because I was like, you know, am I losing my mind? You know, what just happened?
We do that a lot. But most
yeah.
of us don't take it. I mean, the road trance, when you're driving down the freeway and you miss the exit you're supposed to turn off on because your mind was somewhere else, you're in a trance. Or if you go to a movie and afterwards you leave the theater and you feel sort of confused and you surprised there's still light out and you can't quite remember where you parked the car, you're in a trance while you're watching the movie. Or if you're talking to a close friend in what seems like only 10 minutes, it was an hour. Again, you were in a trance. And those trances are powerful, and they could be used for all kinds of things, but people just don't take advantage of that. They just sort of ignore it usually. But here you didn't. You paid attention to it too. That was great.
Well, it was kind of because everything that I was seeing sort of disappeared because it was a shift in I was seeing it in another time when those buildings weren't there and the trees weren't there and different trees were, and it was pretty bizarre in one way.
Do you remember what was happening at the time you went to?
The same thing that was happening at the time I was, pretty much nothing. It was just, the trees were there. The buildings were gone. It was very, very unsettling in a way, experience, because of the fact that it was so accidental.
But I think that's an experience that you can learn to cultivate and have more frequently and take advantage of. And that kind of experience is very powerful and you can learn a lot from it if you let yourself do it.
Right, and that sort of made me believe in the possibility of remembering past lives, of essentially, at least mentally speaking, time travel even.
Exactly, right. And it's there. I mean, like I said, I didn't used to pay much attention, but now with doing a static trance, I really value that and really believe in it and really feel like I have. I don't think I'm quite where, there's a book, The Way Life Used to Be, something of that nature, by Vine DeLora, the Native American who died a few years ago. It was the last book he wrote, but it's a collection of hundreds of stories of Native American medicine men and their experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And over and over and over again, these experiences, were able to, there's a hunting party out hunting somewhere, and the people back in the village or where they're staying could see and knows what's happening, maybe 10 miles away. And this happens over and over and over again. I don't think I'm not that skilled yet. I now think that if I really practice this and really work on it, that maybe I can become that skilled of knowing what's going on in a different, across the valley from where I live here and what friends are doing.
It's also people who talk about remote viewing. And, I've been told over and over again, it's not a thing, that it's something that anybody can do. And at the same time, I'm like, oh, I don't know about this. I'm not sure anybody can do it. That's like saying anybody can run, therefore anybody can be an Olympic runner. Well, no, that's not entirely true. But,
right.
So, I'm not so sure it's not, there's not something
I think there's a capability there, I think many people are better than others.
Right.
I find that artists, I have several different artists in my group, and they have incredibly vivid experiences. And I think it's somehow because of the way they visualize art. I had a person who was a high school physics teacher in the group, and he just was not having experiences at all. And one day he told this elaborate experience, and at the end he laughed and said, "Oh, I just made that up." But I had to tell him, look, stories that you make up are very relevant to you. You can't make up a story that doesn't have some meaning in your life. And so even his using his imaginative story, I think, was important. And I think if he would let go of his rational thinking of being a physics teacher and let that happen more often, develop the skill of having these experiences. So I think it's something that can be learned, and like any learning, some people learn it better than others. But I think it is available to most all of us.
So maybe if you are good at visualizing things, perhaps the ecstatic trance would come easier to you?
Exactly. Or good at making up stories.
I think to make up stories, in a sense, you have to visualize it, don't you?
Yeah, I guess you have to visualize it, but I think the visualization may be different for different people. Some people may be more words than images. But right, exactly. I think the person who has that ability is much more open to letting themselves experience something beyond themselves.
Right. Well, when I think about it, when I write something, whether it's fiction or I'm writing a recipe, I do a lot of visualizing through the whole process. Even in a recipe, you know, as I write the ingredients, I'm seeing the ingredients in my head.
Wow.
You know, that when I read something, each word, in a sense, creates its own symbol,
visual image,
right, that you associate with the movement, with the physical object, with whatever word you're looking at. So there's, you know, most of us are doing an incredible amount of visualization, whether we realize it or not. Even people listening to us tonight, they're visualizing what we're saying, what we look like, how we move our hands while we're talking. You know, they have this whole image going on in their head that may or may not have a whole lot with the way we really look or how we move our hands.
But I know one of my friends in the Imagery Association, he did a study on vividness, and he points out that a lot of people, some people have this real vivid imagination and ability to see images. Others don't. Others just maybe experience it in terms of words. So I don't think everyone is like you, but even so, I think the person who just may visualize the words, maybe, you know, you're making a recipe, maybe you have are more in touch with the flavors rather than the image of what the ingredients look like. Now, I think maybe
You know, it's not just you're seeing the thing, you're smelling it, tasting it, hearing it. I'll admit, I have a vivid imagination. As a teenager, going over an overpass, looking out and imagining what would happen if someone reached out and touched the guardrail as they were driving at 55 miles an hour. The image was so vivid that for probably 2 years, I went out of my way did not have to go over that overpass because it scared me to death.
Well, sure.
I mean, right now, the flood port, everything, you know, and it was like, oh, yuck. I was scared to death of that overpass. So, I probably do have a little more vivid than the average guys.
Musician probably has a much more vivid auditory imagination in terms of hearing sounds and maybe not seeing the images like you do.
And I'm not crazy about, you know, gory images, and
sure.
I happen to be one of these people.
That overpass and that bear and the and the rooster and all those images.
I do, as my mother used to put it when I was a kid, I have a wild imagination. A crawdaddy could become a man-eating monster at all 2 inches, you know. As a child, I was deathly afraid of crawfish, which people in the South, because I lived in New Orleans before I moved to Mississippi, they would laugh if they knew how terrified of crawdads I had been.
Wow. Well, with your vivid imagination, if you really cultivated it in this direction, really, you know, probably go back and really commune well with your ancestors, or with reach out to someone who lives 10 miles away and know what's going on with that person. I mean, I think that kind of ability can really be cultivated.
Well, you certainly made the whole idea of ecstatic trance very attractive. It was something that, you know, I'd heard discussed in other groups, you know, years and years ago, as an alternative to the ayahuasca and peyote type of experience. And it was, you know, more appealing to me than, I mean, I have to admit, anything that starts off with consuming something that's going to make you vomit violently doesn't have a lot of appeal to me, okay? Yeah. It was like, yuck, I mean, who wants to do that? And, yeah, so the idea of these trances without the physical effects was appealing. And so,
before this is over, I'd like to make a couple other comments about some things that are available to the listeners. If you go on the internet at the Kuamungi Institute or the Vidman Institute, either way, it gives a whole list of workshops that we offer. I mean, I'll be teaching one at the Institute, and I'll be teaching one also this summer here in Pennsylvania. And the one I'm teaching here in Pennsylvania will be with Belinda Gore. She'll be working with me. And she was the one that wrote these two other books about ecstatic trance.
Didn't she also do the foreword to your book?
Excuse me?
Didn't she also write the foreword in your book?
Yeah, she wrote the foreword in the book, right.
Yeah, yeah.
She'll be doing this workshop with me here in Pennsylvania. So on the internet, at Kuamungi, that's Cuyamungue, KuamungiInstitute.com, you can see a whole list of the activities that will be happening this summer at the Institute and other places around the country.
Great, great, because we are running out of time. So one more time, you want to give everybody the title of your book?
Okay, the book is The Power of Ecstatic Trance, Practices in Healing, Spiritual Growth, and Accessing the Universal Mind.
It's
available from Amazon.
I was telling everybody, I've got the book in my hot little fist. It is definitely worthwhile picking up and reading. So go out and look for it. Just get on Amazon and look for it. And you got any last comment before we go, Nick?
On the cover of the book, there's that one picture of the person sitting with his elbow, a hand on his elbow. That's a divination posture. And that particular posture, I myself found at the Branly Museum in Paris. And I used it and discovered that how powerful it was for divination. So that's one of my favorite postures.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right, folks, with that, we have run out of time, unfortunately, and I could listen to Nick for another couple hours easily. So we may have to get you back again soon. So I hope you've enjoyed it, and I hope that everyone has found that tonight's program has given them plenty of food for thought, as well as more illumination for your personal truth. Tune in again next time as we bring another guest, another topic, and a whole new idea for your consideration. You've been listening to The Dawn of Shades, and I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.
System and extending to interstellar regions beyond. This is the Kevin Smith Show.
comments and views expressed on The Kevin Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you happen to be, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth. Thanks for being here.